we finally talk about the Me Too movement and the lack of independent media. So, may we have your attention, please?
They are asking the public question and the CPM question.
Hi, and welcome back to Attention Please podcast on Talking Stuff Network. This is episode 18, recorded on 2nd December India time, and I am Vikram Mohan. I'm very excited about today's episode. We have a guest, someone we wanted on for a long time now. So I'm happy to be in the front row for this episode and listen to Arnab and our guest. So let's get your host, Arnab. Hi, Arnab. And how was your week?
The week was great because this is the post-Thanksgiving week. So you're getting back to work and all the work has piled up on your desk. So in that case, in that respect, it was a great week. Before we, rather than me going into my rather shitty week, at least I was trying to couch that. It was a bad week, but we have a great guest today, and we've been trying to get for a long time. We have Harini Kalamur today. She's somebody whose work I greatly admire. I love her writing. I think she's one of the most balanced political voices on Twitter and on social media. I've been following her for a long time, and really, really admired her. The way she makes her points. I may not agree with her always. That's fine, but I think she makes her points very forcefully, very logically. I really, really love her writing, and I'm honored to have her on the show today. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for asking me, and I have loved your work too.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
And I completely admire the way you juggle multiple things, including podcasts and regular blogging and writing books and writing academic books. I think it's fantastic. I think there must be two of you, at least. Vikram and I were discussing whether you are Batman before the show.
Thanks a lot. Yes, it's a challenge sometimes, having so many balls up in this sky while juggling, but it's also immensely fulfilling because sometimes everything kind of comes together perfectly, and you really, really enjoy that. So today we wanted to, since we have Harini here, we want to discuss something which I have personally not really discussed. Many people have written to me saying, why didn't you discuss this when this was front and center in the news cycle? I did in a way, but I didn't quite handle the hashtag head on, which is Me Too. And the reason why I didn't want to do so was very simple, because I don't think that I will be an authentic voice for Me Too. By the very definition, it's very obviously why. So I wanted someone who was talking about Me Too on social media, saying things which I agreed with, and some things I didn't agree with, perhaps. But that's why I wanted Harini to be the person who I wanted to bring this up now. Now that it's kind of out of the news cycle, that's also good. So we can kind of have a more dispassionate discussion over
yes.
it.
Yes.
So let's. That's very important. Sometimes, when it's in the news cycle, there's like something happening every hour. And sometimes just the emotion of that. And we're talking about real people. Real things that happened. There's a lot of going back and forth. So it's good that we can talk about this right now without. And I want to keep the focus less on people and more on the general principle of it. And, how do you define it?
That makes sense.
Yes. So I'm not so interested in was he innocent? That's not so important at this point of time. So the first question that I wanted to ask you was, a few days ago, I think it was Mohanlal, the doyen of the Malayali film industry, who said something like Me Too is a passing fad. What is your opinion on this? So let's start off with this kind of full toss question.
Okay, I hope it's not a passing fad. I think that the trouble with the way issues are represented in the media is that there's an overkill and then it dies out. For example, if you look at the Nirbhaya case, For the next 3 months, 4 months, we heard about rape cases over and over again till I think people got bored with it and moved on. And I think the same thing is happening with Me Too. A lot of people who are activists and talking about it are still talking about it. But the general pickup from media as well as audiences, there's a law of diminishing marginal returns. So I think that it needs to be sustained. It has to be organized. And I've said this before, that it needs to get organized into a larger thing of gender rights and gender equality at the workplace, which means it's seen as a movement and not a series of moments.
So the question that I had, Harini, was that how should we at all scope Me Too? Or in other words, is Me Too just for workplace sexual harassment? Or does Me Too encompass a set of behaviors which go beyond the workplace also? And the reason why I ask is because while this Me Too movement, while it was in the news cycle, there were a lot of cases of workplace harassment, but there were some cases in which they were not really related to workplace harassment, but could be considered to be harassment outside the workplace.
I don't think that Me Too has particularly anything to do with the workplace. I think it's an overall balance between the genders. I mean, that's how I see it. Some of its manifestations might be in the workplace, but it could also be in other spaces. For example, girls in colleges who walk into a college and are CT marrified by guys standing outside can say Me Too. Okay. Or for example, I wrote about this last week. What I believe is in India, there is 33% of domestic abuse. Okay, 33% of all married women face domestic abuse. And I honestly believe that the remaining 67%, of a few of them are in absolute denial, because we don't usually think of things like pinching and pushing as domestic violence, but this is the space in which they exist. So I think that it's an entire culture of speaking out, saying that I will not take any more crap. Okay, that I have been socialized to be quiet. I've been socialized to be to be told that it impacts my honor, but it's not my shame. It's the shame of the man who behaves that way. So I see it in a larger context, but. My great problem with this, with in many of these cases, is the is when we turn into, when the rest of us who are not directly involved turn into online lynch mobs. I also believe in the stuff in things like that somebody needs to be found guilty beyond just the accusation.
But is it possible, given that some of these things have happened years ago? I'm not talking about, you know, some of these things are verbal. It's he says, she says. It might not even have happened like many years ago. How could he even prove these beyond doubt? Is it impossible in these cases?
I think that my problem is not so much with the accusation, because it's coming out of the system. Okay, it's years of humiliation. I was once groped in a train a very long time ago. It's just the years of humiliation you carry with you. It just comes out one day. So I think that the women are seeing this as a way of expressing themselves. Not just women, a lot of men who have suppressed these memories for years have come out and said, this happened with me. And I think that's required, but I'm slightly against all of the rest of us banding together and saying, lynch them, lynch them, lynch them, rather like a Madame Defarge and the French Revolution. I think I'm slightly scared of the sanctimonious reaction of the crowds, which wants blood, no matter what. Sometimes the women don't want vengeance. They just want to be heard.
Okay, but there's an interesting thing, and I really wanted to bring this up. So when you say lynch mob, in case of the French Revolution, it was people were being guillotined. So, you know, it was very evident what was happening to them. But over here, what do you think constitutes lynching? Is it deprivation of their, you know, losing their job, not being able, for many people, you know, stand-up comedians, for not being able to perform on a stage ever? And what do you think is appropriate? There should be some restitution, right?
I think that most of the famous guys, okay, most of the famous guys in the US, I think that the average time it took for them to get back to their career path was 8 months. Okay, with MJ Akbar writing an article for Hindustan Times, with somebody else performing in some other show, and something else coming through with a lot of these guys. I think it's been less than a month. It's not even 8 weeks before they're back in action. So I think it's the instant. It's a requirement for instant justice for the not so well-known men. That seems problematic. See, if the famous guys are going to fall back on their feet, are going to get back on their feet, and they're going to move on. Trust me, it will not even take 4 months before they're back in action. The forgiveness has already begun for a lot of people.
Right. I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I 100% agree with that. That there are some people... Yeah, go on.
So I'm not so worried about the famous guys. I think they'll land back on their feet because their network is extremely strong. But if you're a 23-year-old small-town boy who has come to Bombay, okay, who doesn't have a famous godfather or a godmother, or you are a 26-year-old small-town girl who has come to Bombay and doesn't have anybody famous, and you are the accuser or the accused, what's going to happen to you? The girl will never find a job. The guy will never find a job.
That's exactly true. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the problem really is that most of our lives are now Googleable and searchable. So yeah. When something like this happens, and I'm, again, if I look at the people, and I don't want to take names, but there's some very famous people, and you mentioned MJ Akbar, we can mention his name. You know, but then, as you said, there are some people who are not that famous. There's some people who are, you know, is it middle level, everyday guys, and they're now permanently immortalized. And some people say, and again, this valid that, you know, when you were doing this, you should have realized that this could be a consequence of your actions.
It's a consequence for the women as well, and it's a consequence for the men as well. The consequence for the women is, and this has happened in every sexual harassment case I've seen, the woman is automatically labeled a troublemaker. And therefore, employment prospects become very difficult because references are all word of mouth.
True. That's absolutely okay, true.
And nobody likes a sexual harassment case. The HR doesn't like it. Senior management doesn't like it. Your colleagues don't like it. Because nobody wants to confront. And therefore, this is something that you carry as a woman outside the workplace as well. So not only have you had to face harassment, you have to carry this entire thing of, oh, but she is not a team player. She does not understand a joke. She's a troublemaker with you. And I've seen that happen enough number of times. As far as a guy is concerned, I mean, a 23, 25, 27, I'm talking about first timers. I'm not talking about the guys who think of it as a perk of their trade. Unfortunately, while I'm not making excuses for them, this is what they've grown up watching. This is what they've grown up seeing. They've grown up seeing men who chase women getting the girl in every movie, every popular song that you can come across. Stalking is a way of wooing. A couple of years ago, when they had the women's bill happening in India, one of the things that Justice Verma committee recommended that criminalize stalking. And I think one of the politicians from UP stood up and said, "Agar ye ban karoge, to hamari shaadiyan kaise hogi?" Okay, so you are talking about nobody has told them it is wrong, and suddenly it is wrong. And what happens to them? I'm very curious about what happens to these people who are not famous, who don't have famous godfathers, who have been accused of harassment. What happens to them?
That's interesting. I think one thing that I hope will be, I hope will result from this. I honestly believe that, and I was skeptical when the whole Nirbhaya thing happened. I honestly felt, and I'm wrong now in retrospect, that nothing's going to happen. This is a fad. But I think, and I may be alone in this, that I think the country changed. I'm not saying that it did change after that. I mean, there's a definite pre-Nirbhaya and there's a post-Nirbhaya in terms of the public discourse, in terms of what's considered acceptable, what's not considered acceptable. It's changed. We have all changed. I have changed. Everything changed that day. So, you know, you have these watershed moments, which at that point of time, you're cynical and you think nothing's going to happen really, but it does in retrospect. Do you think that at least, without getting into the, like, will this ruin the career, will this ruin the career of so-and-so, do you think at least it will bring about, at least in workplaces, a greater understanding of the HR policies that need to be in place, that when somebody complains, and looking at some of the Me Too stories, I mean, this is not the first time the people were talking about this. They had already told this, they'd spoken about this to HR, and HR basically said, you know, put up with this or shut up, or you know what, you're the only person who's saying these things. Will this at least lead to that change, that we have some kind of procedural controls, that any company which is making even a rupee of revenue will put in some kind of controls? People who are signing contracts with movie makers will put in some kind of clause regarding this, that this is grounds for termination.
I think that it's two things. I think it's a second watershed moment. I think the first one happened with the Tarun Tejpal case, that's when most companies woke up and took heed of the Vishakha Committee findings, as well as the need to have anti-sexual harassment committees in their workplace. But unfortunately, it was more a knee-jerk reaction to comply with what the government had mandated. And I must say this, the Indian government has some of the best laws as far as these are concerned. I mean, technically speaking, nobody should get harassed and nobody should get raped because the penalty is so high as per the law. But unfortunately, companies paid just lip service for it. But right now with Me Too, I see a far more organized response from organizations in terms of putting in place committees, in terms of taking the process more seriously. I think there has to be a fundamental way in which things are investigated right now. The onus of investigation is predominantly internal. And the trouble with internal investigations is you're all invested in the person. So if I have to investigate a senior colleague of mine, I am going to be conflicted. Whether I like him or dislike him, that's going to come out in my investigation. So I think that it needs to move in such a way that maybe investigations are held by outsiders, with maybe one or two people from the company keeping an eye on it. But I think that we need to have a certain level of unbiasedness in committees, and that cannot happen when it's happening inside. But I do see companies taking this entire process more seriously. And I think the second part of it, one is that men have become more aware that this kind of boys will be boys behavior is not acceptable. Okay, calling a girl chamak chori or chaliya or chamya or whatever else that was normal parlance is no longer on, amongst other things. That's one part of it. Number two, I think senior management have now become aware that groping women is not a perk of the position. It's not right. It's in fact downright criminal. And I think women, because of the Me Too movement and what Tanushree Dutta and Sandhya Menon and everybody else who spoke up did, was they have said the shame is no longer mine. And I think that's huge. The moment the societal weight of shame is yours, speaking up becomes difficult. I think that what this movement has done is taken away the shame. You may still have the guilt, you may still have the remorse, you may still have the regret, you may still have the anger, but you definitely know the shame is not yours. And I think that's fantastic. The fact that a woman can speak up and say, he poured me, he molested me, he abused me, and you don't look like a victim anymore. You don't look like abla aurat. And I think that's huge.
So, yeah. Basically, Harini, now Me Too has ended some careers, right, in both Hollywood and India. But the major difference I see, yes, is that in Hollywood, it's only it's both the accused and in many cases, even the perpetrators, thankfully, whose careers have ended. But if down here, it's only the accusers so far. I mean, if you take Chinmay's experience, for example, it's blatant the way, you know, she's being, within quotes, put in her place.
Absolutely.
They don't make any bones about it. So my question is, can we expect this movement to continue in India? I mean, given the consequences one has to face.
I think we have a very good minister for women's affairs. I mean, Maneka Gandhi is a very, very strong support out there. And I think that anybody who handles that portfolio usually has been very pro-women. So I think that the government support as far as legislation is concerned, or whether support is concerned to sort out these issues, are there. See, MJ Akbar has lost his job. There are enough number of people who have stepped down. So I think there is penalty happening in India as well. At the same time, people like I was reading somewhere where after 8 months of the Me Too accusations, a lot of men have gotten back into fame and glory again. Harvey Weinstein might be an exception, like MJ.
Kevin Spacey
is an exception. Yeah, Kevin Spacey also, his career is pretty much tata bye bye. And I think high time. I mean, I'm very happy that these things are happening, and I think Nana Patekar is facing action. I think Alok Nath is facing action. So I think that it's a combination of two. I think that some men will get away, but I think that the message is going out loud and clear that this is not going to be acceptable anymore. I think that women are being supported both by women and by a lot of the men. A lot of the men don't approve of this kind of behavior. I think that's something that we also should keep in mind.
Down south, though, it's not that encouraging, is it?
Down south, it's terribly, whether it is Kerala and that famous case with Dilip, and or whether it's Chinmay's case, it's. But those are very patriarchal. I mean, despite what you see in the media, those are very patriarchal film industry spaces. Bombay is not so bad in comparison. Bollywood is not so bad in comparison. it's pretty awful there. And it is Omerta, and it is it's literally an old boys network. And I hope something can happen there, but I don't see any chance.
So one thing, Harini, that I brought up in a previous podcast was this notion and this that with workplace, with respect to some of the Me Too things, you know, especially when they're inside the workplace. I mean, dealing with people, there's always this notion of, I mean, I'm not talking about groping, but there is also this notion of verbal, right? You know,
yeah.
This guy asking me out. So groping, everybody knows. I mean, somebody says we don't, you know, that they're lying. Everybody knows.
Groping is easy. Absolutely. Groping is easy to handle.
Very easy to handle. It's either happened or didn't happen. But, yeah. And it's very easy. And everybody knows. The perpetrator knows, the victim knows that it's not right. Everybody knows that. Now, there is the more gray area, especially of, and my stance is a little extreme on this. I honestly feel, I'm putting this in one sentence, there is no room in today's workplace for office romances. Because I personally believe that that the office environment, being as it is, it's not a club, or it's not, you know, going out to a pub or anything. It is a place where you come to work, where all of us have roles. It's naturally the place of friction. And, you know, there's always going to be, there are only few top spots and a lot of people vying for it. So there is, as it is, as a corporation, there is a lot of tension among employees, whether you like to acknowledge it or not. Putting romance, even consensual romance, as part, you know, putting that in is like basically putting a, you know, putting the fire to the powder keg. Because
I completely agree with you.
And I remember this when I first came to the US, and this was 99, you have to understand. We had no idea of what sexual harassment was. So the first time that I came here, I was going to be a teaching assistant, and they had like 2 days of orientation where they first went through. And I remember one of the things that the lawyer said, which kind of stuck to me, was that it's not a question of A and B being engaged in a consensual relationship. It's not that, you know, A can say, yeah, it's consensual. B can say it's consensual. The problem is the problem is for C, the third person, who cannot obviously have that kind of relationship with either A and B. That person can legitimately say that he or she is being sexually harassed, because then there's an expectation of romance or sex or whatever in the workplace. It could be between people who have a power differential, which makes it even worse, or it could be people who don't have a power differential, who are colleagues, but tomorrow, you know, in an office structure, it's not often that it has to be a boss and a subordinate. Even colleagues have different kinds of powers. They have different kinds of roles. And so for me, I believe, and please weigh in, I think that there should be very little tolerance for office romances. It's just could bring a lot of trouble. And this is not why you go to work for.
I agree with you. I believe there should be very strong anti-fraternization policies. I mean, it's there in any organization. When I first joined way back, I mean, if you had a romance with somebody, it was assumed that one of you will quit. It wasn't formalized. Okay. When I first began working, organizations that I interacted with had very strong anti-fraternization policies. So if everybody's happy for you if you fall in love and so on and so forth, but if you fall in love and decide to get married or date or whatever, it was expected that one of you would quit. And I think that's very much required, because you are, as you rightly said, not running a club. It's not a singles club. It's not a social club. It's a workplace with very definite goals. Be friends, go out drinking, do whatever you want. But you are right. Romances, interdepartmental, intercompany romances end up increasing the balance of power or concentration of power in the hands of the couple, vis-a-vis everybody else.
Yes.
And I have heard of stories where people who are couples have run businesses, and when they used to bring their fights to the workplace, because that's obviously the second part of it. When things are going fine, it may be fantastic. What do you have? What happens when they start fighting? What happens when it becomes personal? What happens? I don't know. Don't even want to get there. I mean, you need to. I think people need to learn to keep their distance at the workplace. You come here for work, do your work, and go home.
Yes, and we discussed this, Vikram, if you remember, before in a previous episode, but that's not the way it's kind of messaged. That sometimes, you know, companies say, come here, have fun. You know, we have this team building exercise. And I understand that there's a need to have that, but then there's a line. And sometimes people don't realize Sometimes naturally, they don't realize that there is a line that this is, we might be pretending to be a family, but we are not really a family. We are people who are basically competing against each other to move to the next place, or at least we're collaborating and we're getting paid for it. That's it.
I think a lot of the newer companies that adopted these kind of laissez-faire organizational policies are finding themselves in deep trouble. The companies that have the strongest rules are the ones that are doing the best. I mean, let's be honest. You need a certain kind of rule to be able to build organizations. And see, if you borrow the good things from the West, it's fantastic. But when we look at them and we borrow their org cultures, we aren't set up for that. Yeah, our social systems are very different. We are not as egalitarian as those in the West. And it is going to go wrong.
And let me tell you, Harini, having worked here all my adult life, and I've gone to India, I haven't worked in India ever, but I've kind of seen the way people fraternize in kind of an office context. It's much more informal. And I often feel, wait, aren't they being, I'm not talking about that, just being sexual in nature, but I just feel people have a tendency to overshare their lives with their office colleagues. Yeah. Here, at least the culture is, there is a boundary that everyone has. It's not a question of HR coming and imposing it. There is a place. You don't ask some things about me. You don't comment on my weight. You don't comment if I'm having a romance with somebody. So, I mean, you just don't ask those questions. But people ask these questions at workplace all the time.
But that's a very Indian thing. It's like you going to somebody's house and they're looking at you saying, how much do you earn? Like, seriously? or why haven't you had children? These are normal questions in India, which I think Westerners would die before they don't even ask these questions of themselves, let alone their closest friends.
And these questions have no place in the workplace. Absolutely no place in the workplace. This is a gateway drug to where it ends up.
In my opinion, I think it all comes from one thing, which is this, that we don't know how to fraternize as equals. I'm using this word in a generic sense, in a secular, genderless space. Okay, we haven't been taught this. And I think certain kinds of behavior need to be taught. And when I say secular, I don't mean religious, obviously. I mean, literally, I mean in secular, I don't care about what your personal life is kind of space.
Right.
Or your religious belief. Or
I think what you said about the minister who said, if you know, if this doesn't happen, we will not be able to get married. I think it hits the root of the problem that people have to understand, men and women both, that we have to have, even romantically, we have to have alternate forms of interaction which does not involve pursuing and harassment. And that is a fundamental behavior change.
But how do you talk? How do you do that? Most boys and most girls, before they reach, let's say, a college level, have never spoken to a person of the opposite sex.
Exactly.
When I was growing up, I mean, having a chai with a boy outside college was considered a commitment for marriage. I mean, we obviously, it wasn't maybe that bad. Maybe I exaggerate slightly, but it was considered a commitment. It was a huge thing. If you drank chai with a boy in the tapri outside, you are probably dating him or something. You're making a statement. You didn't do those kind of things. And for those of us who were brought up without brothers or sisters, it became even more difficult. I have brothers, so I probably know how to deal with younger men or men. Very simply because I grew up with them, played with them, fought with them, played cricket with them. But if I have mentally segregated spaces for boys and girls, even if they go to co-ed schools, then how do they get to have normal conversations and how do they learn to interact with them in a way that isn't offensive, especially when they learn from their surroundings that CT marofying is okay or stalking is okay? Boys don't grow up thinking of women as girls. They grow up thinking of women as mal. And that's a genuine problem.
I agree. It's a question of a pursuit, a thing that you have to obtain. Like,
I would suggest sex education lessons right from college. Not sex education lessons, which maybe we call them something else so that it doesn't ruffle political feathers. Gender interaction courses or whatever. I mean, but where you simply get to learn to...
I mean, gender interactions have to happen. I think that one of the big things about I absolutely agree. I think one of the things is people learn need to learn. This is not a thing that can be done through fear, but it's not going to happen in our generation. Possibly it's going to take the next generation for this to happen. I think it's changed a lot. But it has changed a lot, of course. I think that we have become better. At least our generation has become better than what it was before. But I think we still have a long way to go in order to normalize, bring down. I think many of the things that come out, especially when it comes out with older men, you can see that this is also a function of the age that they grew up in. Whereas you said, they believe that, and we're going to come to that, that they believe that that women, that access to women is a privilege that comes with their fame, or it's a perk that is due to them, like, you know, flying first class on an aircraft. That they believe even if you're calling me to your function, you need to pay for first class tickets. I'm famous. Just like that, this is something which is as natural to them. And that's because they've grown up. And I wanted to bring this in again to something which I discussed last time, that at least the way I look at some of these workplace harassment things is a specialization of a more general malaise, which is the feudal structure of our life, which is reflected in our workplaces. Even if you look at some of the experiences that women talk about among their, like, super bosses coming out, you know, calling them up to their hotel room, you know, greeting them in their underclothes, you know, asking them to serve them wine. I mean, this seems like, you know, Sultan, right? It seems like Jahapana, you know, he's in his inner chambers. It's so feudal. It's like staring it in the face. That yes, it's sexual harassment, but it's feudalism. And even if it's not a woman, in this case, it is a man and a woman. But even if it's a man and another man, and there is no, you know, there's no sexuality involved, there is still this desire, there's this feudal attitude of those who are in power to make you feel lesser of a human being. And so it's sexual, but it's also a power thing. And so have you ever felt this, and do you agree?
No, I'm actually, to be very honest, I'm woefully ignorant. I've turned a blind eye to all this. I prod on as though everybody is my equal, whether it's a pune or whether it's the head of the company, it doesn't matter. And it's one of those, I kept telling my parents, it's one of those things that they did terrible about my upbringing, because I don't see power structures, but I know they exist. It's very odd you should mention it. In one of the companies that I was working for, I was once told by a colleague of mine, he says, aap log sab professional ho, angrezi bhi padhe likho, aap apne aap ko professional mante ho. He says, lekin Hindi mein professional ka arth hai nokri. Okay? And he says, nokri ka mool shabd hai nokar. He says, aapko ye samajh mein nahi aata hai ki aap nokar ho. You're behaving like an equal. And I'm standing there with my jaw dropping and coming up again, saying that, dude, you are actually right. It never ever occurred to me. And I have seen, leave out sexual harassment for now. I have seen younger colleagues or even older colleagues being sent to homes of senior colleagues to teach their kids maths. Okay, teach their kids maths because they were good at maths and the kid was bad at maths. Or I've seen girls taking the family out for shopping. Even there's a gender bias. I mean, girls shopping le jao, ladke jaake maths padhao. But it exists, and people do that because if they don't see that, they're again seen as troublemakers. So there is an extremely strong feudal system. And I don't think it's an Indian thing alone. When a Harvey Weinstein, who's not Indian, abuses these women, he does so because he can. Across the world, those power structures haven't changed. I mean, we may call ourselves democracies and liberal democracies and egalitarian spaces and meritocracies. But he or she who wields power has always wielded power and used that power to demand stuff from people, coerce them, in fact. So I think that it happens. It shouldn't happen, but it happens.
I would disagree with you on one point. Again, Weinstein is an example, but Weinstein is purely sexual. He's a director, you know. He's, and in Hollywood, again, it's always considered to be, let's say, goes beyond what would be normal in a workplace environment. Hollywood always had its rules of its own, like any
Bollywood
industry.
As Bollywood,
any movie industry considers themselves. I mean, it has, let's say, you know, the personalities, because of the adulation they get, because of the amount of money they get, it is an atypical environment, I would say. I think that more typical environments, corporate environments, at least the ones that I have seen in the US, and again, my experience is purely of the US, I've never seen, I've seen bad bosses and I've seen, you know, bad, you know, like any place, I've seen good bosses, I've seen bad bosses, but it was never expected that you do anything for the for your superiors that goes beyond your role. I mean, some person can make you work a lot, but even the work will be related to your role.
Oh yeah,
it's not going to be go and pick up my kids from music practice. No boss here would ever ask. Even the worst kind of boss in the US will never ask, because it goes beyond his conception of what he can do as a boss. He can definitely ask him to work late at night, write more code, but this is not something which he will do, even if he's the worst of bosses.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. I was talking this time about sexual harassment. You are right. You are right. Nobody will send you to run errands in the West. They would do it themselves.
They would do it themselves. They won't even think that it's something which they can do.
They won't even think about it. Absolutely.
they won't even think about it. Well, moving on to the next topic that I wanted to bring up, since you've been in the Indian media for a long time, and you know, you've seen from the evolution of Indian media, just wanted to bring up with you, I mean, something which I've noticed and I've commented several times on this podcast is the increasing partisanship of the Indian media. I mean, before that there was a bias, but now you have camps. I mean, depending on which channel of the TV you're on, you know exactly what's going on and what angle, which channel will cover which stories, which channels will ignore which stories. And do you think this is a recent post 2016, post 2014, post digital social media era? Do you think this has always been the case?
I think that media has pretty much, let's look at the media, it helps to look at the ownership of media. Media has always been, right from the inception, time of it started, media has always been run by people who have had very strong views. It used to be the newspaper barons earlier, and they had either very firm government, pro-government views or very strong anti-government views. If I look at, let's say, somebody like a Rupert Murdoch, he literally brought in the conservative, neoconservative movement across the West, whether it was Britain, whether it's America, whether it's a whole bunch of other countries. If you look at the independence movement in India, whether it was a Lajpat Rai or whether it was a Tilak or whether it's a Gandhi or whether it's a Ambedkar, even in an illiterate country, a partisan press played a very important role in propagating the message. So I think that at a whole part of time, in its inception, media was very partisan. And then came the Second World War. And theory tells you this, when you read media theory and media history, there was this entire overwhelming belief that media now should be seen as balanced. Okay, and the balance was always towards science and technology and liberal European American views. So there's always a bias. So for the longest time, I stayed in Britain for about 10 years. And in the entire period, which is about 86 to 95, I never saw a single National Front or an extreme right person on TV. TV, newspapers, everybody had perished them. Now what you have is a democratization of media. And with the democratization of media, what is possible is for us to be able to focus on our own interests. So if I'm a liberal, I don't necessarily now have to engage with anybody else. And if you're a conservative, you don't. So the media is helping us create our own echo chambers and stay within that. And I think what mainstream media is doing is, rather than hedge its bets, it's taking sides, which is really a very silly position because it's literally giving up everybody else. So yes, I see a lot more partisanship, but there was always partisanship, except for the point of time where you said that we need to appear balanced. But when we were growing up, Arnab, the Express was still an anti-government paper, as it is now. Its position was anti-government. And Times was always a pro-government paper, as it is now.
Hello, yes. So I agree. Is it a good thing? Is it inevitable? For me, I think... Again, when I grew up, I've never gone to journalism school, or I don't know the theory of journalism, but it was generally accepted that you are kind of obliged to at least be fair with the fair and balanced. Unfortunately, these two words can't be used together anymore. Unfortunately, but Murdoch killed those two words together and individually. But it was expected that at least in terms of representation of facts, opinion, that's fine. A newspaper carries opinions. There was editorial page for opinions. But at least with respect to the presentation of facts, that you were obliged to carry facts, even if it disagreed with the position of your newspaper. Now, this was an assumption. Yeah, so this was an assumption. Okay. I'm not saying that we could... Again, the problem when we were growing up was there were very few newspapers. Like, we used to... In Calcutta, we used to get Telegraph. So we didn't get Times of India, we didn't get Indian Express, we didn't get Hindu. And there was no way of knowing what they were saying. So we either had Telegraph or we had Statesman. Or you could go and read Anand Bazar Potrika if you were reading Bengali. But there was very limited options. Now everybody can read every city's newspaper. So that's fundamentally changed. So we were never, nothing we were reading was being cross-validated with anybody else. We took whatever we got as fact. So, but over what I'm seeing nowadays, it's not just a question of opinion. I mean, when I tune in to Arnav Goswami, I know at this point of time that what I'm going to hear. Or I tune in to Nidhi Razdan, I know what I'm going to hear. But what I've heard is that the people who are presenting us facts apply a filter at the very introduction of the fact. They refuse to cover certain stories. It's not a question of them giving an opinion, but for them, that story does not exist. And that they believe that that is their journalistic prerogative, that, you know, that they get to choose.
But that is agenda setting. It is you are trying to tell people what to think, not what to think about. So as media, you are suggesting the list of priorities that people ought to focus on. So, for example, why do we hear about a farmer's march or agrarian distress only when farmers marched to Delhi? I mean, it didn't happen on one day. It's something that is built up. Or, for example, why do we not hear about, let's say, Dalit groups when we hear about, let's say, a Me Too? Because this is what media wants to focus on. Because that's where the eyeballs are. I think that's a fundamental problem here, Arnav. And the problem is that you have a problem with the business model of media. Currently, every single newspaper, every single website is being run as an advertiser magnet. Okay, get in the eyeballs and advertisers will put in money. The more eyeballs you have, the more money you get. Very few people are going in for a subscription, which means that your costs of generating, you not only have to create content, you have to create a lot of it to keep people engaged. And to do that, you are really not going to spend time on facts. It's easier to have opinions than have facts. And it's easier to do stuff that is in people's immediate surround system than it is to do things that are far away. And that has its own problems. Your generation, my generation, our generation, when we grew up, Doordarshan and All India Radio was the only source of information outside newspapers. And I really believe that DD and AIR built this entire identity that we both have of being Indian. My parents, I don't think, felt as Indian as we do in terms of they were more Tamil or Telugu or Bengali or whatever else. Their regional identities carried through. But for our generation, DD and AIR made us. Whereas if I look at news channels today and what it's doing, it's literally micro-segmenting us and polarizing us. So I think it is definitely a bad thing, but I think unless they look at their models as being something that delivers value, that people are willing to pay for, they're not going to be able to put money into facts. It's easier to have eight people screaming at each other than looking at what's wrong, what's bust in the Indian healthcare system, or in the Indian education system, or why are so many Indian graduates unemployable? There are enough news stories. They're just not people being able to investigate those.
So do you think subscription? Yes, it does. And do you think it's kind of useless saying, oh, we should have a subscription-based system, when I don't think anybody has been able to create a valid working subscription-based system in this day and age, that ultimately everything is going to be eyeballs and clicks driven in this day and age. So we might as well put up with it because there is no alternative.
No, I think that it's a question of expectations. Let's look at a newspaper like Times of India. Okay, it has a subscription, let's say X lakhs in India. I don't know what its subscription is right now. A few years ago, it was 4 lakhs, but I think it's much more than that. So X lakhs is its subscription in terms of people buying a physical copy. Now, when it comes to digital entities, you're not satisfied with X lakhs. You want X times N million as readers, which means you throw more and more stuff at Google gods, at the servers, so that more and more audiences come in. I think we have to have a viable view of what kind of subscription basis newspapers and news magazines are going to have. Just because you can reach the entire world doesn't mean that the entire world is going to read you. So if the moment you are focused on saying, okay, I need 1 million people or 2 million people or 10 million people, you focus on that rather than getting in the entire world. I'll give you an example. In India especially, you have this acute problem. If I look at newspapers, you pay like 4 rupees to 5 rupees a day for your newspaper, which is like nothing. You pay more for a cup of cutting chai. If I look at news channels, you pay less than a rupee a month for a news channel, which means you're paying like 3 paise a day. You're getting better content than what you're paying for. People are getting what they pay for. So if you say Arnab Goswami is terrible or Nidhi Razdan is terrible, they both are giving you far more value than you're paying for. You're paying nothing for it. And until Indian consumers or Western consumers or news consumers start becoming more discerning as far as news is concerned and start paying 5 rupees a day, 10 rupees a day, whatever, for their news fix, you're going to continue seeing this happen. And the more companies rely on advertising, the more junk you're going to see and the more polarization you're going to see. It's easier for me to write a controversial piece on Ram than to write a measured piece on Ram. Or for example, my favorite example, I keep this in colleges all the time. If I have two news clips, 5-minute news clips, one is the top 5 economic policies of Narendra Modi or Rahul Gandhi, okay? And I have a show called Kaun Banegi, Rahul Ki Dulhan Ya, whatever. The audience is going to come for the latter. No matter how well researched and how important the former is, the audience is going to come for the latter. And what news channels are doing and newspapers are doing is rather than give the former, which is what they're supposed to do, because they are the fourth pillar of democracy, they give them the latter. They give you Kim Kardashian, but they don't give you anything that's important. So yeah, you have a problem. You have a genuine problem. It's a worldwide problem.
It's a worldwide problem. And again, in India, I think it's even worse. At least in the US, you have New York Times and Washington Post, and you know they don't have to cover that Timur waved at a cat kind of news. In order to keep the lights on, that they can
Express and you have a Hindu and you have fairly boring old-fashioned newspapers. You have the EPW. You have even on the right, you have My End. You have Swarajya, which is doing fairly decent work at times. You have people coming up, but the numbers are never going to match up unless you start paying for the content. If an Express or a Swarajya or whoever else wants to do an investigative report, they need to know at least 30,000 people are reading.
Right. And that's the thing. Nobody wants to pay. And I also understand that nowadays, see, when we grew
it's
up...
Nobody wants to pay. I want to cut you. I don't think that nobody wants to pay. I think maybe 1 lakh of people want to pay, or 2 lakh people want to pay, or 5 lakh people want to pay. I think we have to identify our audience and cater and create the product around the audience. The audience is not everybody. There's no such thing as everybody. Unfortunately, most news is created for everybody, which is, unless you're a Disney film, you can't be for everybody.
So, but is it even possible to find out this niche? And I understand that there are websites like Ken and which are like doing very focused subscription-based models for tech. And I understand that there might be a critical mass. But I would say the reason why media organizations want to target everybody is because of the same reason why frogs lay thousands of eggs. Because they don't know which of the tadpoles will become frogs. What kind of target will you have? Will people who really care for Bollywood movies, will they in this day and age pay for gossip? When I was growing up, they did. They did pay for Stardust. They did for Filmfare.
Okay, I'm going to be very blunt here. Okay, I'm probably going to get trolled by everybody. But I don't think Bollywood coverage is news. Okay, I don't think Kim Kardashian's butt is news. I think news is stuff that is genuinely going to impact my life and yours because of things that will go wrong. For example, the earliest definitions of news were politics, central government economics, judiciary, sports, weather. Okay, that's
but
it.
How is sports different from movies? Like, for instance, there could be someone for whom it's very relevant where Ranbir Kapoor split up with Katrina Kaif. That's driving his or her life more than what the farmers are doing or what if India is beating Australia. That's their life. So you know, for them, that's news, right?
So, I don't disagree. I'm simply saying that while it may be news, all news platforms don't have to devote all the spaces for all the stories. So if you are a serious news platform, I don't see why I need... Okay, let me give you my example as a consumer. The way I curate my news is, I curate my news on a Flipboard or wherever. I have topics on which I see. You will never see a Kim Kardashian coming up because for me, it's a waste of time. Okay. Not that I have anything against her. I think she's a fantastic person. She's done great stuff as far as her career is concerned. But I am not interested in her life or her love life. Okay. Or for example, you will not find cricket or IPL in my stream because I'm not interested in that. On the other hand, you might find science and technology. Now, these are things that I might actually end up paying for. I do pay for news. I pay for The Economist. I pay for The New York Times primarily because of their science and tech coverage. I pay for The Caravan in India. I pay for reportage. I pay for good content. Now, there's only so much good content I can pay for, but I'm still paying. I'm paying 5 rupees, 10 rupees, 20 rupees a month, whatever, for content. Can you catch the people who are interested in content and build products around them rather than spray on everybody and not get anything? As long as you look at everybody as your target audience, you're going to get junk as news. Because it's based on people clicking as fast as possible so that you can monetize their eyeballs as fast as possible. And therefore, verification, truth, newsworthiness, none of those exist. And news is about all of those. It's about making sure you and I as citizens know what are policy implications that can screw us. We need to know what our legislators are debating because that can have a direct impact on our life. We need to know where public funds are going. We need to know whether public health organizations are delivering or not. We need to know whether schools are delivering or not. Wherever we need the function of news in society, we aren't finding news. And all reports tell us that that kind of reportage is actually dwindling and dying, leaving journalism as the mental equivalent of McDonald's deep fries.
I mean, it's entertainment. I mean, Harini, ultimately, media has to. I mean, news. Even if we define, if we take movies and entertainment and all the fun things out of it, and say, okay, I use the word fun, so I kind of tipped my hand on that one. So if we take that out, ultimately, in this day and age, everybody has to fight for, you know, you have to fight with Netflix in terms of retention.
When I watch Netflix, I actually come away with value. So when I watch a Daredevil, I come away saying, what a fantastically made show, what lovely narrator, what fantastic storytelling. Or for example, when I go for a nice meal at a nice restaurant, I come away with that sense of taste and that flavor and everything else. This is literally what you have in news is none of this. You don't have even the engagement. It is, I am flicking through, and by the way, I consume 23 seconds of your content before I flip to the next one. It's literally the equivalent of eating French fries at McDonald's. It does to your brain what McDonald's French fries will do to your kidneys or your liver or everything else. It's bad. It's bad for people to consume so much of bad news. Bad as in not bad news, but badly constructed. This is not news. This is stuff we used to do 15 years ago or not when we started. We were far more responsible bloggers than in those days with limited followers than most news platforms are as broadcasters.
Absolutely. There's one thing which I heard, and please tell me if I'm right or wrong, but again, I heard this from one person, was that, you know, she said that working in news channels and working in media, she was part of the media, much, much more an insider than I've ever been. I've never been once, unfortunately. So, and she said that a lot of money that comes from things like things which you don't even consider as revenue streams, like events. And after she said that, I've been kind of monitoring every channel, like India Today, every month they have some kind of big ticket event, which only their channel covers, of course, because that's really the value they bring. And apparently they make a lot of money through events and other things, which the advertisement at the event. So ancillary things, which kind of spring off the events, which have nothing to do with their news coverage, that kind of subsidizes their news coverage in a way.
But there's a problem with that, which is this. Let's say, for example, you are a media company and you have an event. Let's say you are holding an automobile event. Okay, getting people into the automobile industry to sponsor, to speak. But the automobile industry is also the major sponsor of this event. Are you of going course. To really do stories which tell you a certain kind of car is good or bad?
No, you can't. I mean, that's you're absolutely right.
So, therefore, you are not acting in... So, this entire myth that we have been sold that the media acts in public interest is not true. You are They're not acting in public interest. They are acting pretty much like every other corporate around and corporate interest. And therefore, the question is very simple. Should the media be accorded any more benefits than, let's say, a FMCG company is? So, for example, if I'm looking about at a HUL or a P&G, they go through a whole bunch of regulation as far as their products are concerned. HUL can't suddenly launch a soap into the market without going through all the clearances. So should media be allowed to do all of this? If it's acting like a typical fast-moving consumer goods company, should it be treated with the same rules as fast-moving consumer goods? If you're not acting in public interest, if you're not standing up for the average citizen, if you're not bringing up stories that are going to make a difference to our lives, you're only screaming and shouting. Maybe we should just impose entertainment tax on you and deal with you the way we deal with the movie industry.
That's a very interesting. I mean, I honestly feel they should be taxed like the movie industry because there is no difference between them and the movie industry.
There is no difference.
For good or bad.
At least if I see Amar Akbar, to be very honest, right now, if I saw Amar Akbar Anthony, I walk away with education. I walk away with some knowledge. I walk away with some feeling of good, feeling good. I feel better as a human being. When I watch news, I feel none of those.
Right. I agree. I mean, I've become extremely disappointed personally with news. I mean, I'll accept. I used to like Arnab Goswami when he first, when he first was in Times Now, which was, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. It seems like ages now, but I used to think that he was a little different. But now when I see Republic TV, I cannot believe what I'm watching. Is this a parody? Is this a parody show? I mean, what is this? How can this be allowed to go on? This is like the worst of B-grade movies. Like the worst I've seen. Is that? And it gets progressively worse. And it gets progressively worse. That's what I've seen. And I've lost all respect for television.
I haven't seen news television since 2011. I gave away my TV. I stopped watching news. I see some clips on YouTube occasionally, and I'm very glad I don't, because I see news channels, however well-intentioned they are, to go out of their way to create strife. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. You can't be creative. Well, aag pe tel mat dal. They go out, and this is... I'm not looking at whether it's left-wing channels or right-wing channels or pro-government or anti-government. It's this entire tendency to lie and to blatantly lie and try and cause trouble where no trouble existed. And I think that's fundamentally morally wrong. I'm very old-fashioned about this. But I think it's wrong. Lying is wrong. Lying to cause trouble is wrong.
I agree. I mean, you're right. I mean, I believe that it's the role of the media in a perfect world to bring about strife. Strife is good. They are a pillar of the democracy and they are there as an ombudsman. So if they cause strife by bringing the truth to us, that's fine. But sometimes they are, as you rightfully said, they are creating strife. I mean, one of the pet themes that many shows, I think, nowadays have is whenever you have anything which involves India and Pakistan, and I haven't seen this before, it's just like started 2 or 3 years ago. And again, Mr. Goswami is the pioneer of this. They bring these rent and experts from Pakistan whose sole reason for being there is to be provocative. I mean, you can't bring one sensible guy from Pakistan. They'll all say the same thing and they do that so that they get called back again. And it's ratings heaven for these guys because they get to see, okay, here's the worst thing you can think of the other guy. Guess what? We have him. It's not just Pakistan. It's for anybody on the other edge. So there are Hindu fundamentalist guys who have made a living. There are Muslim fundamentalist guys who have made a living. There are people who have just made a living being television stars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Being nasty, being awful, and being provocative. And ultimately, people aren't that bad. I think that one of the things that media makes us think is the world is a terrible place. The world is not so bad. There are nice people in the world, mostly nice people. Otherwise, we would be burning.
Hey, that's an optimistic way to end this podcast.
No, they're genuinely nice people. There are more people who are out there to do good than do bad. There are more right-wingers who believe in peace than they believe in lynching. There are more left-wingers who believe in peace than they want absolute revolution. So I don't know why we should stick and look at the worst of our species and put them on news.
I agree. And I also believe that even the people who we think of worst, at least on television, many of them are publicly posturing. At least I know two people who appear, I know personally two people who appear unhinged on television, who I've had private conversations with, and they're not like that. So they're not like that at all in real life. They're much more reasonable. And you wonder, why is this guy so different in real life than he is? I remember, Ram Guha, for instance, Ram Guha, when you see his writings, when you read his writings, he appears very, very, let's say, set in his ways, and he has a very specific and very extreme positions on many things. Now, I remember when he came to Kolkata Lit Meet, it was again a public forum, but he was basically grading India on its history. So what have we done well as a nation? What haven't we done well as a nation? It was a very nice talk. And while it was going on, I felt, well, this guy seems so rational and so balanced here. I wonder whether it was my perception of him that was wrong. And then somebody in the audience stood up and asked him the exact same question, that, my goodness, you sound so different in real life than when I read your than read what you write. And he said, you're possibly right.
But I think that works. It's very difficult to remain balanced. I find that sometimes when I write an edgy column, which is rather an irrational piece, it does so much better than when I write a rational piece. And it just disappoints me so much, because it's so easy to write clickbait. It is so difficult to write the other type. And yet, clickbait gets me so much more views and so many more comments than writing stuff in a balanced way or a researched way. And I sometimes wonder whether I should really bother doing the latter. It just makes you lazier. It's easier for me to be irrational than it is for me to be rational.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's again another persistent theme in this podcast is I've been ruining the fact that the centrist space has been totally taken out, that we have become a donut. There's nothing inside. There's everything which is like... Yeah. Swirling in the periphery. And that's precisely because of that. Nobody wants balance, because whenever somebody reads a balanced piece, they don't recognize the fact that, okay, I agree with 50% of this guy. They only focus on the 50% I don't agree with. And
the one line they disagree. Actually, not even 50%, it's one line.
One line they disagree, that's it. They have formed an opinion based on that. So pretty much 100 people read it, they all hate it for different lines in your piece, and you end up being hated by all of them. And with extremist positions, there's this nice simplicity that everything is, you either 100% hate it or 100% like it. And everybody wants that kind of an audience. Because if people 100% hate you, by the way, they're still clicking and reading your piece. They're reading it much more than the guy who 100% agrees with you, by the way. So
Absolutely.
It just makes life so much more easier to be at the extreme end of the spectrum. It absolutely does.
But I think I like being a contrarian, so I shall persist with a certain amount of balance. It's okay. It's okay if people don't, if I don't get 100% likes. It's okay.
Yes, it's okay. Again, I also feel it's okay. And I can say that because I'm outside the media. I have another job which pays the bills, and I don't need this to put food on the plate. But I wouldn't be able to do this if I was actually trying to make a living from this. I don't think that I would be able to persist. One of the things why I started this podcast is because I want to see the economic viability of having, and it might sound a little grand for me to say this based on a weekly podcast, but I want to explore the possibility of having a moderate centrist media platform. And even if it can even be financially sustaining, and I'm still testing it out, but the part of me, you know, the rational part of me says it's just not possible. It's much easier if I start a right-wing site or a left-wing site, and that can be sustained. You know, micro-targeting, as you said, to your audience, getting them to subscribe, and, you know, having a sustained model rather than, you know, being centered and kind of trying to appeal to everyone and being hated by everyone else.
I think I can live with that. I mean, it's good to be hated. It at least means that you're doing something. It's okay.
It's good to be passionate. It is not good to be mildly hated.
I think that I'm mildly hated.
Donald Trump, he wants to be passionately hated. He wants to be passionately loved. He wants to be passionately hated. And he, I think, more than anybody captures, I mean, that's why he's a president. Can you imagine this guy became president? Because, you know, growing up and being a master of reality TV, he understands that the way to win in this day and age is to be either absolutely loved or absolutely hated. I mean, that's why people in reality shows, they turn in to watch the villain. They never eliminate the villain because, you know, that guy gets the eyeball. So Trump, for instance, and I think many politicians, Trump is a trailblazer in that respect. I think many politicians will realize it as the years go on. That is absolutely good. It's not good to be at the center, that you should be absolutely hated or absolutely liked. That's the way forward.
I think that this dose of polarization, I think society's come back to the center. What I find absolutely amusing about India is that the BJP is moving to the center, and so is the Congress. And they're both in the opposite ends of the spectrum of a Hindutva, which is quite bizarre. Okay, they're fighting for the same center space. They're both fighting for a center space now.
That's a very interesting perspective. And that's what happens in the US elections too, because the extremes will always go with their man. It's the center, which is the undecideds, they call them here, that swing the state. So with Trump, he gets the undecideds away from Hillary. And those people are kind of white, blue-collar voters who come and vote over to Trump. So it's not that he doesn't realize that, you know, in order to win the elections, you need to go for the center. But otherwise, the very important thing is, minus the 5 months preceding an election, nobody really cares for the center. Everybody cares for the base.
Nobody cares.
And they care for the extreme.
No, we are the ones who are going to settle it. We are the ones who are going to settle the elections, because they will come towards us sooner or later. But I think you're right. I think there's a space. I have been exploring this for the last seven, 8 months to see if there's a space for a centrist magazine stroke publication. I think that news on a daily basis is just too much. It's just too much. There's just an overwhelming amount, quantity of news. There's a content glut. I mean, literally, we are drowning in content.
We are drowning in content, and much of it is terrible. But some of it is very good, also. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that I read, even in places which I don't agree with. Where even if I don't agree with pretty much everything the article said, I would accept that it's quite well written and well argued, and even the sleights of hand that have been used are rather subtle, and you have to kind of applaud it. Maybe just a slow clap that, you know, well done, sir. But
yeah.
Okay, so this great was great. This was a great conversation. This was great fun, man. We should do it again.
That was fun.
We will do
before
this
the elections.
Again. Before the elections, yes, we'll definitely do it before the elections. We need to have a more election-focused show where we should discuss the individual candidates. We didn't really get into politics today, but that's good. There is just too much politics, so it's good that we didn't discuss politics. So
yes, it was
thanks a lot for coming. And Vikram, you want to take it? Vikram, you want to take it away now?
Vikram, I'll mail you the song.
Yep. So like Harini said, we do have a what song contest if you're waiting for it. And today's what song, of course, is a pick from Harini. So I think we'll let that be a clue. She's not going to do what. I'm assuming she's not going to go with the genre or the time which we usually do. So we'll see what song Harini comes up with. And this is the song for this week.
Ladakpan mein hi ye duniya luti Ajab hai daasta teri ya zindagi Kabhi hasa diya, rula diya, kabhi.
So Harini, do you want to give out your Twitter handle and your blog URL before we wrap up?
Yeah, our Twitter handle is Kalamur, C-A-L-A-M-U-R. And blog handle is kalamur.org/Gargi, G-A-R-G-I.
Perfect. So that's where you can find Harini. And of course, Arnab, you are at greatbong.net and at greatbong. So I do hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. And if you're listening to this on our site, you might want to consider subscribing to the podcast using a podcast player. You'll find all the details at talkingstuff.net/app. And just hit the subscribe tab and you'll get links to download the right apps and also to subscribe to the podcast. As for me, you'll find me on Twitter at the Vikram Mohan. And I also co-host the Talking Tech podcast with Vinayak, which is available wherever this podcast is. So we'll be back next week. So until then, keep calm and keep listening to podcasts. Thanks and bye-bye.